This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our editor at large. And Ann, at long last, we have a Quentin Tarantino movie going to the Cannes.
I'm so glad we were right about that. I was not going to let it go. Because, you know, here's the thing. We kept having people tell us, you know, Leo's going to be there. You know, Quentin's going. You know, they have a night set aside, you know.
I mean, who? I don't know the specifics here of, was it really not clear if it was ready or not, or did they just want to keep us in suspense? But Quentin Tarantino wants his movies at Cannes, and if there's even a possibility of him doing that, he's going to do it. So, of course,
we just gave him some breathing room and gave him an out in case he didn't feel confident. What I'm excited about is that he wouldn't be bringing it if he wasn't confident, although there's a good possibility that what he really wants is the friendliest audience on the planet.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you say if he wasn't confident, when is he not confident about what he's doing?
If you haven't finished your edit, you know, if you
well,
haven't,
I don't
but
know.
He's willing, he's going to go back and do it. You know, he'll make it shorter if he has to. It'll be a test run.
Of course, I was just thinking back at Cannes 2007 when Death Proof premiered there after the catastrophic release of Grindhouse, where it was a totally different cut and was folded in with this Robert Rodriguez thing. I mean, Tarantino's always got a new vision for what he's doing. The Hateful Eight dropped on Netflix as a miniseries last week. So whether
that
or not
was really interesting. Started. I cannot wait. Did you look at it? Did you have time?
No, in fact, if
I
you
would look at that. I
Did
would want to see it totally, but well, I haven't had time either.
How many people are actually watching? I mean, not to say that it's not a fascinating, sort of variation on the concept of a director's cut, but it was a tough movie in the first place and had a lot. It asked a lot of its audience, but perhaps this is the best fate is for people who really do want this sprawling Tarantino unleashed kind of experience to experience it in bite-sized pieces.
Well, I like the idea that he went in and because he spoke to Slash Film about it. It's actually a fascinating interview for those of you who are Tarantino aficionados. Just the idea that he would go back to all of the different, you know how people edit movies, they need to tell it from this point of view or that point of view. Each scene has to play out at a certain length. He could go back and look at all the different points of view and re-edit them into a different sequence and look at, you know, completely change the way that it played out. I love that idea.
Yeah. But with respect to the new movie, it's really an open question. So the running time is 2 hours and 45 minutes, which is relatively palatable by Tarantino standards.
It's in the usual realm. Yeah.
So I guess the real open question we have now is just how much is this movie going to, you know, scratch that itch that Tarantino fans want versus everybody else? Because
it's expensive.
Studio movie,
and
right?
And Sony is asking. Now, by the way, Sony's totally behind the Cannes launch. They get it. They know that this is a good audience for him. The critics are going to be receptive. He's done very well there over the years, really well. So I think this will be a question of what Sony's expectations are and what kind of it's going to cost a lot of money to release the movie and put it out there. I hope it's accessible. I hope it's going to be commercial and artistic, but Cannes is really about artistic, isn't it?
Usually, but we'll see how good Rocket Man is, right? I mean,
that's a commercial launch. That's going to open up right afterwards, and you're as skeptical as I am that it's going to be artistic.
And I'd be happily be proven wrong by it, but
we don't know.
Cannes is about the art. Cannes is about the at least the perception of cinema as an art form from as many different angles as possible. And I think one of the things that's kind of cool about the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood situation is that it's also about celebrating the history of film. And this seems to be a major Cannes auteur celebrating the history of film. It's like Cannes crack. It's almost like it was conceived for Cannes.
Well, he gets to do, I wouldn't go that far, but he gets to play around with period. It has to do with Hollywood in a way, because it's Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski and the Manson murders. And it's all set in the Hollywood milieu with the actor played by Leo DiCaprio, the fading Western star, and then his stuntman played by Brad Pitt. I was doing some very early Oscar, just laying out the landscape of what some of the films are going to be and some of the stars who might be in the running. And Brad Pitt playing a supporting role. That's interesting. I mean, I'm curious to see how big his role is and how big Margot Robbie's role is as Sharon Tate. We don't know.
Presumably not that big, given that this is the year of the
Manson. It's a sprawling ensemble.
Yeah.
She gets killed. Okay.
I mean, spoiler alert.
But the other question is, when we see, and I don't think they're showing it ahead of time, although there's a junket in London, Rocket Man, one of the questions is whether they've gone for the R rating, the nude scenes, the love scenes with Richard Madden and Taron Egerton. There's going to be a hue and cry, and I hope they are prepared for this if they try to sanitize the sexuality of Elton John.
Well,
see the point.
We just found out that the film, after its Cannes screening, will play at an LGBT festival in Canada.
Presumably they're embracing this.
Yeah, I mean, did they accept the film sight unseen or not? I don't know. But that, I mean, if there is backlash and it's playing an LGBT festival, that would be an issue. But I think in the case of both of those movies, the Cannes launch will be crucial to sort of defining the next stage of their lives, given the scope and the kind. These are the flashiest films that will be at Cannes this year. Sorry, Jim Jarmusch. I mean, I'm more excited about.
I'm excited about Jim Jarmusch. I'm going to talk to Tilda. You're going to talk to Bill Murray. What's not to like?
No, I mean, this is what's more exciting, I think, for us in context, is the Cannes opening night experience. But when Quentin comes to town, you know, that will be the biggest show.
That will be the biggest
show. And I think from the Cannes perspective, to circle back on that, it's also worth pointing out, Cannes needed this, because you look at the
they have no red carpet except for opening night. This is it.
Not as
they needed it desperately.
As much as people may be excited about the new Pedro Almodovar film.
Or the new Asif Kapadia, which got picked up by HBO.
A documentary about a big soccer star or whatever. And so it's like that stuff. That's about as big as you can get in the context.
And then Sony Pictures Classics did pick up Frankie, the Ira Sachs movie starring Isabelle Huppert, who was a very big star in the Cannes firmament.
Yeah, exactly. That's like a Cannes bubble sort of a movie. You know, there's probably something worth checking out there, but it's not like it's going to resonate globally in the same way. So now they don't have to worry about that, which is actually really gratifying, because we can go back to, we know that stuff's going to be on the calendar and it's going to generate a lot of heat. So we can go back to looking at the rest of the lineup to see, you know, where are the discoveries? What are the real Palm contenders? What is the jury going to be really arguing over? I love this stuff.
Me too, of course. And then your Eggers movie ended up in Fortnite, which is actually sort of
predictable. Like how you say your Eggers movie, like I own it or something.
You were waxing eloquent about how that should have been, you know, a competition title. We'll see whether it should have been.
I think it's going to be a very good movie. My hopes are high, and I think they should be for anyone who saw The Witch and saw how accomplished this director was. And the buzz around it is that this one's black and white, sort of homage to silent cinema of sorts, and it's got a supernatural component again with Willem Dafoe, with Robert Pattinson. It's just a very exciting kind of a movie, and the sort of thing where perhaps by putting it in director's fortnight, stands out in a bigger way. Kind of like when Gaspar Noé went to director's Fortnite last year with Climax and ended up winning the section.
They sometimes do this with genre films. It's just a way out. And by the way, I do get annoyed with them. I know that there's so much pressure to get these auteurs into the competition lineup that they end up with putting the documentaries and the animated films somewhere else. They just do it every time. But I am excited by the Asif Kapadia. So the other thing, I did a tribute with at the IDA last night with Werner Herzog. We went through his career and we showed clips, and he was just in great, great form. He had the audience laughing and in the palm of his hand.
When is he not in great form?
No, he really
is.
He's just great. And basically, he said, "Well, he's well into his 70s, and he's in great shape, and he's working harder than ever, almost as if he's running out of time." And one of the films is going to be in Cannes, this Japanese fiction film. He's very invested in the fact that he's not just identified with documentaries. That was very clear to me last night.
Well, the thing that's interesting in that respect is that he's always been working in both modes. He's been making documentaries as long as he's been making features. It's just that he was most famous prior to Grizzly Man for movies like Fitzcarraldo, and then in the last 20-ish years, or more like 15 years, the documentaries have gained more currency.
It's interesting to recognize, as I was looking at his career, in a sort of close-up way, I was realizing how much Aguirre, Wrath of God, and Fitzcarraldo played into, and the documentary Burden of Dreams, the Les Blanc documentary about the making of Fitzcarraldo, how they played into this mythological character of Werner Herzog, who isn't who he's made out to be. Yes, he has been shot at, and he's been in incredibly challenging situations.
Over his head,
you know, and all of that.
Into volcanoes.
He actually didn't jump into any volcanoes.
Well, if you've ever seen Le Soufrière,
When he did Into the Inferno.
Yeah, it depends on what decade we're talking about and which volcano documentary.
He's attracted to volcanoes, which tells you a good deal. Now, he's really, and I said this one thing to him. I said basically, I see you as someone who's just dogged and determined, and you have this rhinoceros hide, and you won't take no for an answer. And he went, "I have a human hide, and I will take no for an answer."
Wow,
and he went on to tell me his no for an answer story, which was quite moving, actually. It had to do with the series that he did on Death Row, and there was a case where if he had included something in the movie, it would have affected the life of a man, and he didn't do it.
Well, I can tell you a little bit about the Cannes project that he has, because I saw him briefly at a dinner at the Tribeca Film Festival. He was making the rounds there with his Gorbachev film, which that originally premiered last fall in Toronto, but was making its stateside premiere, or that stateside, it's a U.S. premiere in New York, and there was a little dinner. So I popped in and I was talking to him about this. He had originally mentioned that he had been in Japan for this movie months ago when I'd seen him, and now that it was going to Cannes, what's kind of fascinating about it is that it still seems very mysterious, because it's so different as a narrative. Family Romance LLC, it's playing out of competition. He shot it in Japan within a couple of days with non-professional actors. He did all the camera work himself. He did it in real locations with hidden cameras, and it's all in Japanese, which he doesn't speak.
Correct. So I asked him that question. Yeah.
But the thing is, of course, he said it's his greatest movie ever. And it's self-financed. I mean, it's kind of interesting, though, because the narrative, it does sound different from a narrative standpoint than anything he's done lately, because his narrative features have never had the kind of scrappy, off the beaten path kind of quality. Even when he does weird stuff, there's usually like a movie star in there who wants
They're usually pretty polished. No, but one of the funny anecdotes from last night had, it was an aside. We were talking about Bad Lieutenant, and I made the claim that it was one of Nick Cage's best performances ever. And I was sort of saying to the audience, you know, it really is. And Werner Herzog says, yeah, it's the best performance he's ever given. You know, that's,
of course he said that.
These people do not lag for ego.
Yeah, no, he always is kind of hilariously over the top. And I mean, is that true? I guess so.
You know, there.
It's interesting because it gives him a lot of room to just mess around. The irony, of course, is that movie, which didn't need to be called Bad Lieutenant and step all over the Abel Ferrara original, you know, created this weird competition for it, even though they're very different movies. And Abel Ferrara's got his own movie coming to Cannes this year. So it's nice to see that both of those guys are still in the game. And it's
but he had something in Tribeca as well.
So Ferrara, that's also notable and worth looking ahead to Cannes, because he may wind up with four movies released this year.
No, but Werner had one in Tribeca too.
Yeah, well, he had his Gorbachev documentary.
Right.
But then Ferrara directed a documentary himself called The Projectionist, which is about a New York theater owner who used to run porn theaters in the 70s and is still in the biz running a range of theaters across multiple boroughs. And it's a little scrappy, but it's a love letter to a different era of movie going, which is kind of the way Ferrara makes movies. It's just sort of, they're freewheeling portraits of a fading New York of sorts, but he's still a very interesting narrative filmmaker. He's got this personal film with Defoe called Tommaso, also screening out of competition at Cannes, with Willem Dafoe playing a version of Ferrara. But in addition to that, his Pasolini movie Willem Dafoe as Pasolini, which was made a couple of years ago, is finally opening in the U.S. through Kino next week. So there are those two films, and then there's the Projectionist documentary, and then he just wrapped one of his biggest movies in a long time, also starring Defoe, called Siberia, which we may see by the fall. So it's kind of great to see these auteur types who aren't on the Tarantino level in terms of necessarily like the resources, the commerciality of their work, but they're still chugging along. And
you know, they could be comparable. What I will say about Werner is that there's a German discipline to him. As much as he goes rogue and puts albino alligators into, you know, French caves and all of that. And he has, I think what that means is that he has a sort of uncanny sense of how to entertain. You know, he talks about ecstatic, reality. You know, he doesn't want to keep to the facts, but at the same time, I think in reality, he's way more of a workaholic kind of work all the time guy who knows how to achieve a very difficult technical ends, you know, and doesn't, whereas I think Ferrara is much more of a crazy guy who can't listen to anyone else and doesn't work with a team and only
That's
gave up
mythology.
Drugs recently.
It's been a couple of years. I think he had a kid and stuff, but he carries that
he's still brand. That guy.
I mean, they're both a little crazy, but great artists tend to be crazy. That's sort of what makes them worth investing in to some degree.
I think they're crazy. I think they're idiosyncratic, both of them, but they're crazy in different ways.
So, speaking of idiosyncratic filmmaking that goes against the grind, Avengers Endgame is making a gajillion dollars.
You know, it's so funny. You and all the other enthusiasts for that movie, which, by the way, I perfectly well enjoyed. I have no issue with it. But I sort of refuse to drink the Kool-Aid and get into this sort of it's the be-all and end-all, and it's going to get all these Oscars and everything. You know, basically, even if you go through the usual what happens to Marvel movies and comic book movies is that they, you know, Black Panther's the best, most successful example, and it went the farthest for all sorts of reasons having to do with Coogler being more of an auteur and bringing in, you know, Ruth Carter and we could see that it had a chance because of this extraordinary originality that it had as the first big Black Panther story that was creating these worlds and creating these costumes and production design and all of that, which were the two of the Oscars it won along with score. But they tend to go with technicals. And Marvel doesn't even have that going for, I mean, Endgame doesn't even have that going for it. It doesn't have original stuff. It's all old stuff. It's stuff they've done before. So your case is that Robert Downey Jr. should have a shot.
Oh yeah. Oh, okay. So that's the enthusiast side of it. So I enjoyed watching the movie again. I went to go see it with my wife over the last weekend, and the crowd reaction is always interesting because you know where the beats are, but different things have different levels of response. And what's funny is you can kind of get a sense for, and very anecdotally, which characters in this very populated universe are most well beloved by, you know, when people cheer, when different people show up. But I just kept thinking, okay, the movie really plays, it's a huge cultural phenomenon, an unprecedentedly large cultural and commercial phenomenon. And it plays to a large degree as a tribute to Robert Downey Jr.'s character. And so I came out of it thinking, given how ubiquitous this movie is and how much respect there is for it in the industry and what Marvel has pulled off here, could you tell a story from an award standpoint around what Robert Downey Jr. has achieved in the past decade? A major comeback, created an iconic
He had two Oscar nominations in the past, so it's not like he's not in that particular zone. But the box office is going to be the best reward.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, he can support generations of children. You know, I don't think anybody's concerned about any of that. I think that just the award side of it was just this question of, you know,
out a supporting actor nomination for him. Although some people are debating that he's the lead in that movie, which
in this one, I think it does come back to him enough where you could make that case. I was saying, if you want to do a supporting actor case, do it for Chris Hemsworth, because he's so
hilarious.
Funny. He's the scene stealer. There's a narrative there.
I love him in this.
I mean, you wouldn't be opposed to that.
He's my favorite
thing. Right?
Absolutely. Totally.
There's respect for what he does there, I think. It's a surprise that Thor, because that was a hard character to launch. He seemed like a bit of a punchline for a while, and then they embrace the punchline, and that really finds it. The apotheosis of that process comes ahead in this movie when he becomes the dude, more or less. So
Slacker.
There.
Slacker,
hey,
Thor.
You don't have to spend a
that
crazy
was Coogler's line.
Yes, yeah, Slacker Thor is
but perfect. The question is, how high is high going to be? And our indefatigable box office guy, using the art of you have to take the adjusted grosses if you're going to compare and contrast, and in the what he came up with was that for a movie in first release, which has nothing to, you know, if you do the math on that, this could get to $1 billion domestic for the first time, be the first one to ever get to $1 billion domestic without re-releases, which is pretty amazing.
It's amazing, and also I think it should be pointed out, a little scary, right? Because of just how powerful one movie can be and what it means for all the competition and for just, you know, how powerful Disney is right now.
Well, Disney is scary because if you looked at the numbers last weekend, in the opening weekend, it really dominated in a way that pulled up all the Disney boats, but not the others, not the other studios. So my line right now is that, you know, Hollywood thought that Netflix was the enemy, and now they're realizing that the one thing they have to worry about now is Disney, Fox. And I feel for Fox too, because what's going on is this very rigorous examination of all the release dates and figuring out what was invested and what they're going to put into each movie and when it's going to open and what kind of support it's going to get. So when I'm looking at the Oscar race or something, and I see something like Woman in the Window, which is Fox 2000, which is a subsidiary of Fox that's being eliminated, so it doesn't have a powerful ally at the head of it, Elizabeth Gabler. She's going to be leaving. She's looking for other jobs. Other people are trying to sign her up as we speak. So you basically have a big Amy Adams, Scott Rudin, you know, movie that could be a big player, and you don't know what kind of support Disney's going to be willing to give it. It's going to be interesting to watch. And then Ad Astra is probably going to come out in the fall.
Right, and we don't know how good that is or if it's a real awards contender or not.
But it has Brad Pitt in it, so that much dictates, and it cost a lot. So, they're going to have to do a commercial release. What they may not have to do is a festival release.
It's that's sort of the open question, is it the kind of movie that will benefit from that kind of framework or not?
Right.
I mean, this is a bit inside baseball, but I was looking at the news that Alan Bergman and Alan Horn now are co-chairmen at Disney.
This is very related to what we're talking about, because I spoke to Alan Horn at the party for Endgame and very briefly, but basically my fear is that, you know, I was worrying about him. I mean, it was like he has too much on his plate.
Exactly.
This made sense to me.
Think about all this stuff at once. It's too
so he can't. And he was handling, you know, he was basically saying, okay, Kevin Feige, do your thing. Here's your budget. He really wasn't, you know, I don't think Alan Horn was in there tinkering with the mechanics of something like Endgame, but he does have to worry about Fox and all of that, all of
somebody's
those decisions, and he's got to fire a lot of people.
Yeah.
So now there's someone to help him with all of those.
It's too bad about that. I mean, I don't envy the situation at Fox right now and how projects that may have seemed totally stable before are now sort of up in the air, but I suppose it'll all be clear.
Well, the other movement in the force is Amy Pascal going over to Universal, which is indicative of certain, people perceived her as sort of the princess with everything, you know, at the top of the Sony food chain with the best deal, but of course the deal ran out. So
well, she also had a rough going there because of what happened with her in the Sony hack. I mean, it was
she was still chairman of Sony at that point, so she had, that was part of what contributed to her having to leave that job.
Exactly. So this is sort of, in some ways, it's like the next stage in that cycle of moving on to the next thing. Although it's a big loss, she brings in a lot of energy and you know, talent relationships and all that kind of stuff. So it's
it's good for them to have. I think she first of all, her buddy Michael DeLuca is over at Universal having a good time over there. He left Sony as well. Tom Rothman is a very hard charging executive, and I do hear a lot of complaints out of Sony. You know, it's a tough place to work, but Pascal could, you know, the world was her oyster. She could go wherever she wanted. So I think she thinks she's going to be happier.
It'll be interesting to see what comes out.
And able to do more of her own thing. I mean, part of what you see in her pattern is that she had to take a lot of her projects elsewhere.
Exactly. So before we wrap up, we should touch on a new movie that opens, because so often we are overwhelmed by other things happening and we don't get a chance to actually look at something in theaters. Longshot is coming out. I saw this back at South by Southwest. You caught up with it a little bit more recently.
I saw it at CinemaCon.
Yeah, that's right, at CinemaCon. So I think it's a fun movie. It's a little too long. It's in a little bumpy in parts, but it's got a certain charm to it. The fantasy that it puts forward of a romance between
a schlub who gets to have Charlize Theron fall in love with him.
But the thing is, the story around like how that could actually happen drives me nuts, because that part of the movie is a fantasy, but that's not the part of it that's hard to buy. The fantasy is the kind of political climate that it envisions, under which Charlize Theron becomes basically a presidential candidate. It makes
it pretty good. Goes from Secretary of State.
Yeah, and then the president,
that's what Hillary Clinton did, yeah, right?
No, exactly. But I mean, it happens in a certain kind of loopy way with the president, who's sort of this Trumpian character. He's a
buffoon.
Actor. Yeah,
in other words,
I think that he wants to go back to
he's good.
He's very good.
Exactly. No, but here's the thing. I like this movie a lot. I really enjoyed it and I laughed my head off. And truth be told, I really like Seth Rogen. I think he's a better actor than a lot of people give him credit for. And I think he absolutely makes you buy the idea that he's smart and sharp and funny and that they knew each other as kids.
That's part of it. The point I was trying to make is like, okay, it's not just like the schlubby guy gets the hot chick or whatever the crass reduction of all these people have been putting out there. Like, they have a history together. Maybe she's
kind of... And they make it believable.
Yeah, there's like a nostalgia thing. And then like the thing that they bond, like the thing that finally gets them together romantically is...
Drugs.
They're like, their lives are in danger at one point. There are things that happen that kind of allow you to buy into the relationship.
But you also buy into the lonely workaholic achiever who has to look a certain way and put on a certain facade, but underneath is completely unfulfilled. You're identifying with the schlub, the Brady schlub, and I'm identifying with the workaholic achiever.
No, it's not that. I don't identify with the dopey guy. Especially, you know, to be honest with you, the movie.
Oh, come on, Eric.
No, I'm not going to say that I identify
with Seth Rogen could play you.
He's certainly welcome to try, but I don't know. I've never been quite that much of a slacker as far as I
don't think Charlize Theron could play me. No, that's off the table.
The thing is, like, I do get a little annoyed by the way that journalists are portrayed in movies, and I don't think this movie really portrays he's supposed to be this, like, Village Voice type of, like, muckraking journalist type.
Yeah, they're in the past. They're in some fantasy past.
And he's not, like, a very convincing one, I'll be honest with you. But anyway, it doesn't matter. It's a fantasy. I'll buy it. You can go see it before Quentin Tarantino or whoever else shows up and takes over the world. So next week we will be in Cannes mode. I'm going to Paris later in the week. So I'll already have all kinds of different European movies on the brain. And I'm sure Tarantino will continue to build hype, but we'll have plenty of other things to dig into. I hope you get a chance this weekend to kind of get things in order, because it's about to be a bit of a wild ride.
Bye.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.